Welcome to the Cordwainers In Their Shoes podcast. My name is Katie Greenier and I'm Creative Talent and Network Director at Pentland Brands. Cordwainers are shoemakers, and today the worshipful company of Cordwainers looks to promote footwear design and entrepreneurship in both education and the fashion industry. To celebrate the company's 750th anniversary, we've brought back our podcast for season two to explore what it's like to walk in the shoes of those who have made them. Well, this is so exciting. Today, I'm in a proper studio in Fulham, and the sun is actually shining and the birds are actually singing. And I'm joined by Neil Clifford, who has 30 years of experience in retail. Half of this time has been spent with Europe's largest luxury shoe and accessory retailer, Kurt Geiger. Kurt Geiger currently operates in 28 countries with 57 freestanding retail locations, and it manages the luxury shoe business in the UK department stores, including Harrods and Selfridges. Neil has also expanded the Kurt Geiger business beyond the United Kingdom and has entered into international partnerships and successfully launched the Kurt Geiger business online. So I am delighted that he's with me today. I think we're both a little bit nervous because we're in such a proper studio.
We are. I've never done this before. I'm a podcast virgin.
And he's already sent photos to his daughter. So yeah. I'm going to send photos soon to my husband. So should we start off by going, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Portsmouth. My family are all still in Portsmouth. So yeah, I'm a Pompey boy, the only island city in the UK. So I'm one of few that probably have escaped from there, actually. But I still adore it. It's got a lovely seafront and I go back often.
So how was school for you?
I loved school, but I was not very good at it. And it transpires that I'm very dyslexic, which I didn't really know. And didn't really exist, frankly. You know, everyone's got something nowadays. But I was dyslexic. So I was in like the top classes, but failed everything apart from art. So I got a C in art O level, and that was it. And I always remember that time, because I'm an eternal optimist. So, you know, you've got to go into school and pick up the envelope that was on the board to open it and see what you got. And it was like U, U, E, E.
Oh,
and I'm like,
goodness. Oh, damn. Did you think you'd done well?
No, I didn't really know how to revise because I struggled to keep information in my brain.
Yeah.
So everyone was revising, and it's not as if I was like top of the class, but frankly, it was very rare even then. If you went on to do A levels, you were sort of a little bit strange. But I thought I might get 4 or 5. Most of my friends got 4 or 5 O levels, so I felt a bit despondent with 1. And the weird thing is, and this is sort of true in the pictures on my desk at work, I drew a shoe.
Incredible.
A Dunlop Green Flash sneaker, and that was what I passed my O level with. So maybe it was all a bit written in the stars.
Serendipity.
Really.
Strange. The universe has
strange
provided.
Looking back. And my son is, I've got two sons, and one of them is dyslexic like me. And he loves drawing too, because it's something that you don't have to remember. It comes out of your hands and you haven't got to read books to do well at it.
So do you draw now?
I do draw now, and I adore buying things in art shops. I've got a beautiful little art shop near our office in Farringdon. And if I'm ever stressed or ever sort of feeling not wonderful, I walk round to the little art shop and I buy some pencils, mainly for Vincent now. So A4 sketchbooks and colouring pens and weird rubbers, and I spend an hour in there chatting to the people in the art shop, and that gives me a lot of pleasure. Yeah, art is a thing for me, yeah.
You can't beat a stationery
shop. No, it's amazing.
Oh my God,
and
it's
honestly,
the best.
It is the best one in London as well. So, I would recommend that. Yeah, I love art.
So how did you go from passing 1 O-level, the Dunlop trainer, to what happened next? Mm. How did it all start?
Well, so I left school you know, as you did in 83, June 83, 1-0 level, 16, there wasn't many jobs. Unemployment was at 12%. There was, you know, lots of drama going on. So you went down the job centre and there were the only jobs in there was a thing called the YTS scheme, the youth training scheme. And it was £25 a week and the government paid it, not the company. And you could choose really where to go. And I liked cars, but I was always useless at the physical bit of cars. But my best friend Simon was a mechanic, wanted to be a mechanic. So he went to the Fiat garage in Portsmouth. And I thought, frankly, sod it, I'm going to go with him. So we both got a job. His was being a mechanic and I was in the parts department doing sort of the microfiche and giving people oil filters and things like that. And I was the front of house man because I like people, basically.
And are you good at cars? Did you know all the parts? Did you know how to fix cars?
No. I can't fix anything. I'm totally useless with my hands, apart from drawing. So I was more the people person, really. And I've always been sticky, I suppose. I've always been able to build relationships. It was a front of house job at the Fiat garage in Portsmouth, which I adored that job, but clearly the money wasn't great. But, you know, what else did I have to spend money on, really? So I was there a year. I finished my youth training scheme and then I needed to find another job. And I got the job 100 yards down the road in a hardware shop.
Right.
Because it was between where I was and walking home and there was a job in the window. So I then ended up in a little hardware shop, very much an open all hours, you know, making brooms, cutting keys, delivering paraffin to old ladies. And frankly, I adored that job too. I was there for 2 years, 40 quid a week. So it was like a 60% pay rise. And the only downside of that job was I smelled of paraffin. Because actually those things are super dangerous now, but lots of old people had paraffin heaters. But delivering that meant that you smelt of paraffin. And therefore I was always, my friends used to laugh at me on a Friday night in the pub, like you stink of paraffin. So then I got a job in Debenhams of Southsea for the Burton Group.
Right.
In Principles for Men, that doesn't exist anymore, as a salesperson selling suits. That's how I moved into the sort of retail world.
So just going back, did you have a sense of style, a sense of fashion, a sense of trend then, or not really?
No, I mean, I was obviously a bit potless, so I didn't really have much money. But Portsmouth is a funny place because it has a big sense of style. The men particularly are the peacocks. Maybe that's more normal anyway, but everyone loved dressing up. It was a dressing up place. And we all used to save up our money. There wasn't anything great in Portsmouth to shop, but you would go to Southampton or if you would go to Brighton and you would get your new man shirt or your chippy jeans or your fashionable or your, in fact, Hugo Boss was even super cool in the 80s. So you'd save up your money and you want to dress up. So, and there was a whole sort of the football dresser thing was also big with Burberry and Adidas and Lois Cord. So there was a vibe, there was a thing, and I was part of that.
So were you part of a tribe, would you say?
I'm a bit of a chameleon, really, because I was part of the sort of dresser thing, you know, the Burberry and the cords and all that. And then, but suddenly I became a sort of, maybe not new romantic, I became a bit gothy because I was in a band and I played keyboards in a band. And when I was working at the hardware shop, I also had a night job cleaning toilets because the head office for the UK for IBM was in Portsmouth. So I had this little moped and I used to leave the hardware shop and zoom off to IBM and clean 8 toilets a night because I wanted to buy this Roland JX3P keyboard that the same as what Howard Jones
love that
used. So I was in a band, so I was a bit sort of alternative. I moved from the dresser thing to the sort of Bauhausy thing for a little bit and Stranglers, and music's always been a big part of my life.
So did you teach yourself how to play the keyboard?
I was rubbish. It was the problem. And to the point where...
You were in a band?
Even
what was the band called?
The Identity.
Oh,
and we were on the local Solent radio.
Couldn't have been that bad.
We made our little own records and sent the tapes off to, you know, the BBC. But in the end, this is not completely true, but in the end, because I was like really the worst part of the band, even though I was the sticky guy that made everyone get together and everything. And my mum used to drive us around in her van with all the stuff, and we rehearsed in our garage. The band disbanded and then, surprise, surprise, about a month later, restarted with a new name without me in it. So I think it was very evident. I was no Dave Greenfield from the Stranglers on the keyboard. I was the chord man only. But I did enjoy myself.
So tell me about Debenhams. What happened
there? Oh, I adored that job. Actually, I've adored every job. You know, people say to me now, oh, you're so lucky, you've got this lovely job, you're called CEO, it's amazing. I loved all my, and I think loving work is a really important thing, whatever job you do. But anyway, Debenhams I adored. I was with my mate, John Wilkinson. He was on the Burton's department. I was on principals on the other side of the walkway. We used to throw socks at each other the whole time when there were no customers. But I discovered that I just loved selling things, really. I loved talking to people. I was charming, I suppose, at the time. And it was a success for me. So I thought, this is for me. I don't smell of paraffin. I'm earning more money. I love dressing up. I love work. So I was always there like an hour before I had to be. And I was there an hour after I needed to be, because why wouldn't you be to do a good job? And then I thought, this is my thing. This is what I'm going to stick to.
So how did you discover footwear? What happened?
A longer story, which I'll try and keep it really short. So I then moved to Guildford Debenhams. I got promoted to the assistant manager of Guildford Debenhams. And I met Ralph Halpin. Ralph Halpin lived nearby. And he came in on a Saturday, had a chat with me, as he did. You know, the 80s of the Burton Group was really the Cambridge University of retail. It was bloody fantastic. And chatted away, and I said, look, I just want to get on. I love work. I love my job. I want to, you know, how do I become more successful? I'd never really been to London. And he said, you need to move to London. If you're serious about a career, move to London. So I went home in my little Alfa Romeo down the A3, saw my mum and said, I've got to move to London. So I applied for a job. I was the only person that applied for this job, which was the manager of the store in Woolwich. I didn't even know where Woolwich was. And off I went. My mum took me to a little bedsit in Plumstead in a little Mark 1 Escort. And that was 1988. And I was living in London. I was 21. And suddenly I'd keys to a shop. I was in charge. I've always wanted to be in charge. I'm never horrible to my boss, but I don't really like having a boss. I was always super happy to have the pressure, super happy to have the responsibility. Don't really like being told what to do much. I struggle with that a little bit. And I was in charge. It was wonderful. And that's where my career really rocketed, actually, at that point. I worked my way up. I became the biggest store manager, the youngest store manager, or manager of the year. I became an area manager. I got promoted very early at 23. I had a company car. I had my little Renault 5 Turbo. I then was promoted to be head of merchandising, because suddenly maths made sense to me, even though I was rubbish at it at school when it involved money and things and jobs. I was good at maths. So
isn't it funny though, how just the way you learn and the things that actually inspire you or make you able to do something that you thought, it's the way it's taught at school,
yeah,
it doesn't make
you
sense.
You know, school, you know, I'm still friends of all of the people I was at school with, you know, and men are better at holding on to friends. Maybe we're not so good at sort of finding new ones, but I'm friends with everyone I was at school with. You know, we're on a WhatsApp group of all the people that were in Mayfield School in 1983, but I couldn't hold the data, so therefore I was rubbish at doing the exams. When it became work, it made much more sense to me. Maybe I like money and success and all of that, so maybe I tried a bit harder, I don't know. But I then became this relatively fast-moving success story in the Burton Group, to the point where I was head of merchandising and planning for Champion Sport, and I was, you know, this very successful thing, be it that 5 years ago I was on the YTS scheme in Portsmouth, you know. And then the Burton Group sold Champion Sport. So I had the offer of going to Top Man or Top Shop or Dorothy Perkins, or basically taking the money and run. I was 24. I was living in London with my now wife. We weren't married at that point. We met, and she was in a librarian in Portsmouth, and she ended up in the lovely bookstore in Gower Street, you know, the lovely,
yeah.
It's called Dillard's then, I think it's Waterstones now. And we took the money, we said, sod it, let's go round the world because we really want to travel the world. So, you know, 17 grand then is probably like 50 grand now or 100 grand now or something. But we took the check and went down to Trail Finders on Kensington High Street and bought one of those round the world.
Yeah.
You know, we've all round world tickets.
So how long were you away for?
2 years.
When you arrived back in Heathrow, how was that? That was a bit of a shock to the system.
Well, I was skinny and skint.
Skinny and skint.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, it's all right.
No,
it gives you a challenge.
But I'm like, oh my God, now it's 1995, you know. I travelled in, which was a recessionary time, I suppose. So if you're going to choose time to travel the world, do it in a recession. And I came back and the UK was more optimistic and there were jobs again. And so I applied. No, I knew a headhunter called Jim Logie at RMC. They're based in this really divey little office around the back of Trafalgar Square, Scottish, lovely people. And he was like, I've got this job, Neil. It's called the British Shoe Company. And it's part of Sears. And you could go up there and it's based in Leicester and there's a company car. And I'm like, okay, cool. Get me an interview. I haven't got any money, you know. And it was head of retail and I got the job.
Amazing.
I went up to Leicester, never been to Leicester. Went to this like huge, incredible, crazy place. Thousands of people all eating jam sponge in a cafe. So in this huge cafeteria. And I'm like, my God, what is all this? And I got the job at British Shoe Company. And I was only there 9 months. And the thing was sort of sinking at that point. It was all a bit of a disaster. Be it that, you know, I was very happy to have a job and everything. And I bumped into... Because part of the job was you're running the shoe business in Selfridges, because Selfridges was part of Sears, which was part of the British Shoe Company. I'd never really even been in Selfridges before. And I bumped into this guy on the shop floor and he was like, hi, I heard about you. What's your name? And I'm Neil. And he said, well, I'm Philip and I'm the CEO of Kurt Geiger. And Kurt Geiger was this sort of really posh thing. And it looked after all the designery posh bits. There wasn't much of it in Selfridges at that point. Bruno Marley, Charles Jourdan, Ferragamo. And he was like, well, we're looking for a retail director. You know, come and see me for a coffee. And he was this handsome, suave, sophisticated individual. Looked like Frank Sinatra. And I'm like, wow, this is cool, you know. And I looked, I found, there was no internet then, but I found out about Kurt Geiger and it was part of Harrods. And I'm like, wow, that's super cool. Went for this interview and got the job. And I went from 45 grand to, you know, which I was earning less than what I was earning before traveling, to like 60 grand. And I'm like, this is just, I'm super made up now. I'm head of retail of this posh thing and we've got Harrods and it's all wonderful. And that's where I ended up at Kurt Geiger, basically.
Is Kurt Geiger an actual person? Where does the name come from?
Yeah, he was a real person. He's passed away now. He was this most amazing Austrian shoe designer who came to London via Australia, actually. Obviously, there was pretty clear reasons why he needed to leave Austria in the 30s. Mm-hmm. And ran away with his family to Australia and had a shoe shops in Australia and then came back into London. And he was this incredibly flamboyant individual that had his own shoe line. He was a designer. He designed actually for Roger Vivier and Ferragamo and he knew everyone in the shoe industry. But he also, so he had his own collection and he charmed brands to come into his own shop on Bond Street that he opened in 63. And this store, clearly I'm old, but I'm not that old. I don't remember the store. But if you talk to his family, which I have done, this store was this phenomenal success. It was the hot shoe store on Bond Street, so much so that Harrods asked him to open one of these shops in Harrods. And that's the connection between Kurt Geiger, the person, and the Harrods shoe department. He started that multi-branded, lovely shoe business that now is so big and incredible.
So what was it like when you first joined? Do you remember your
first
day? I
was scared to death. the head office was 11 people above the shop in Bond Street.
Wow.
Which is now actually, what is it now? It's LK Bennett. I've just taken the store. And the company was about £30 million worth of turnover, predominantly running the Harrods shoe business with a few, couple of Kurt Geiger stores, a couple of Carvela stores, tiny little thing in Selfridges in the corner, and not making any money. It was a sort of charity, really, to provide profits for the shoes in Harrods. So Philip was my boss. I was the retail director. And then Philip's boss was Mohammed Al-Fayed, who then, you know, I built a relationship with, and his brother, Ali Fayed. So I then discovered this incredible, crazy thing called Harrods, which I didn't know until that point.
So did you have an ambition? Did you know what your ambition was to make it bigger? Did you, or did you just feel right? How, like, because you've turned it from one almost small thing to quite a dominant feature, not only on the high street, but also in department stores.
I'd be lying to say there was ever this master plan. No, I think because I'm always keen to progress and develop and make things bigger and better, but not in an incredibly strategic way, really. But I suppose when Philip retired, and I went for 2 years to Bali, actually. So I lived in Switzerland for a couple of years. I left Kurt Geiger. I was charmed away by the Texas Pacific private equity group.
Right.
And I thought, wow, I'm going to go and live in Switzerland. Yeah. That sounds amazing. And, you know, I had a beautiful flat on a lake and everything. And I learned a bit about the private equity thing and learned about international and brand development in a more strategic way. And then Mohammed and Ali Fayed said, "You idiot, why have you gone off to Switzerland? You know, you must be crazy. Why do you want to live there? Come back and we'll make you CEO of Kurt Geiger." So I did a little Swiss thing, and then I came back when Philip had retired and became the big boss.
And how did that feel?
Amazing. I was just desperate always to be in charge.
I love that.
I'm never scared. The pressure of being responsible for everything.
And do you think you're a good boss?
I think it's really difficult to do your own review. I hope I am. Yeah, I can be a pest because I'm never content, really. I like to reflect it or rationalise it like Alex Ferguson.
Yeah.
And the only way that I can put logic to it, I'm not comparing myself to Alex Ferguson, but if you read his book, and I'm a Man U fan, you celebrate for 5 minutes and then you put it in a box and put it under your bed and you look forward. And I think that would be my only analogy, that I endeavour to celebrate, maybe not enough, actually, looking back in the last 20-odd years, but I just like the future, really. I'm not a rear-view mirror guy.
I think it's interesting you say about Alex Ferguson, because I watched his documentary the other day and he was talking about the goalkeeper that he'd brought from Aberdeen.
I know, that was so sad. That
and
story.
Then he gets there and he's like, he's not good enough.
Not good enough.
And it's knowing, isn't it, when someone who actually works for you and being brutally honest that they're not good enough.
Yeah, it's a sad story.
And
that.
It's really, I just thought it was one of those moments when I was watching it, you know, that I actually thought, actually, being a great leader is actually knowing the moments when you need to actually turn direction and get, and actually make decisions that sometimes are not easy to move stuff forward.
I think he definitely, if you ask me the question of, you know, who do I think is the most amazing person of pushing things forward and never really being content, but trying to handle that in a positive way, he would be my reference point. And the weird thing is, I'm a happy person. It's not as if I'm a sort of morose, miserable person that is not fun to be around, but I always just like to push things forward. I think it's whether it be the dyslexic part of my brain, because I'm not a list writer. I don't have much written down. It's all spinning around in my head like planets. I'm a multitasker. I can be doing 100 things at once, but in a quite a disorganized way in my head. But, you know, I never forget anything. I'm you know, I get up early. I love getting up early. I'm bouncing out of bed at 4:47. I go to bed at, like, I'm the world's most boring man. I go to bed at 9 o'clock. and I'm out of bed at 4:40 and I just can't wait for the day to start. Any advice to anyone, one of the big things would be get up early. We were all the world, the get up early people.
Yeah. Well, I'm with you there. So, I'm totally in agreement. So, who or what inspires you then every day?
I think just being alive, you know, I just think we're so lucky. If I really sat on the psychiatrist's couch for 30 seconds, I think because all of the bad things in my life happened really early, because that's so done, I've always been an incredible optimist to make the best out of everything you've got. So I think inspiration is just feel super gratitude for your situation.
So what is your proudest moment?
Oh, crikey. What's my proudest moment? Buying Kurt Geiger, if it's a professional question, as opposed to my first child and all those sort of silly answers, it would be making Kurt Geiger independent. So we bought the company. Obviously, we didn't have any money. We borrowed the money. But taking the company independent in July the 4th, Independence Day 2005, that was a big moment. Not because of I was going to make lots of money or whatever, but just it gave the company a bigger future.
And how did you celebrate that moment? Or didn't you?
I have no really idea. I struggle with celebration. I probably honestly, I genuinely can't remember. It was a feeling of, because these things, and I've done 5 or 6 private equity deals. They're very stressful and very time consuming and difficult. It's just a feeling of relief more than anything that you've got it over the line. Because I hate failure. Failure is what I'm scared of most.
So, what has been your most difficult moment?
COVID. I would say seeing the company collapse from a record year, 400 million of sales, 41 million of profits, the best ever year for the company, with a plan to grow that by another 15%, and in 12 weeks that all disappearing to dust. That was quite tricky looking back.
But as a leader, you must have done something amazing to put that back into play, because you've come through the other side of the pandemic and actually you've come out strong where other brands and other companies have really, really struggled.
Well, I think...
What did you put in play in order to get through it? What was your reaction to it?
Well, we did two things. I suppose because we were always, as a board and myself, so obsessed with every single year had to grow, sales and profits had to grow, whatever we needed to do. We delivered it for 20 years, but we did it sometimes in a compromised way. And we ended up with a company that was quite disparate in shape in terms of its distribution. And looking back, in a way, the company had run out of runway a little bit with the shape of what the company was. Suddenly with COVID, it was sort of shaking the Etch-a-Sketch. There was nothing. You had to start all again. And therefore, I felt, okay, well, let's use this crisis to do all of the difficult things that were hidden away in the drawer that you couldn't have done in 2 months ago. So we close a lot of distribution, you know, didn't help, but in a way it did help. The Debenhams then collapsed on me. I mean, we had about 4 COVIDs all at once. But then we decided that we're going to clean up our act from a distribution perspective. We're going to triple the acceleration of international. We're going to make handbags the core of the company, not shoes. We did lots and lots and lots of things. And it's worked so far.
So what would you say was your biggest business lesson coming out from the pandemic?
Be bold, I suppose. Be bold. Sometimes I was... And when you do these private equity things, you know, they buy the company, which is all lovely and everything, and then they do loads of due diligence, even on you as a CEO, and you have to go and meet psychiatrists and they analyse you and they talk about what you were like when you were 8 years old and all these sort of weird things. And often in my reports, you know, I've got all these reports about Neil Clifford and the good and bad of him and everything. It said, you know, charming, good with people, blah, 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 you know, ambitious, driven, can be strategically not as strong, more tactically successful, would always do anything he could to make the numbers work, but maybe sometimes should be more strategic and long-term. And I thought, sod it, I'm going to do that. I'm going to prove everyone wrong. I'm going to think further ahead for the company, use this opportunity to be bolder strategically. And that's what we did.
So now, what would you say the future of Kurt Geiger is? Where do you see it?
Well, the future's global. We are already, with 2 years ahead of our plan internationally, we're as big in America as we are in the UK. Our sales in America are beyond £3 million a week. We're a phenomenon in America. So we know our brand and our product travels. We did an amazing job with our mix of the cocktail of kindness and creativity, and we did a massive amount of work through the COVID period to amplify that, whether it be work with the NHS or our People Empowered thing or topping up our salaries of all of our staff who are on furlough, lots of things. So we think we've got this lovely mix of British spirit, London design, creative mix with kindness and a respect of the human spirit. So we think we've got a nice niche. Our price point is good. Our designs are special and unique. No one designs handbags like us. Go and look at our handbags. I know this is a shoe podcast, yeah, so I need to talk about shoes. But look at our shoes.
No, I think it's okay.
We've got a very good vibe going on creatively that we need to ensure we don't lose that. That's the big thing. So international is our big future. We'll be back to peak profits there about this year, 40-odd million, be it that we're spending three times the amount of money on marketing to sort of communicate our brand globally. Next year we'll be beyond 50. We've got a very, very strong trajectory. So I'm very, very optimistic about the future for the company.
Did I read somewhere that you donated lots of shoes to the NHS?
We did. Yeah, thousands and thousands of pairs. We went into COVID in the worst possible state. We were as close to an airline as possible. You know, we were in a really bad way because we'd planned such an aggressive year ahead of us. So we had 3 million pairs of shoes in our warehouse in Thrapston the day the stores closed. So there was no reason for us to really survive, actually. So we thought, well, what are we going to do with these shoes and handbags? We may as well do something good. My niece was an A&E nurse. She's an A&E nurse in Portsmouth. And the family WhatsApp group, and they all went crazy, didn't they, at that period. And I said to her, is there anything I can do? Because, of course, in the beginning of COVID, we didn't have a vaccine. We didn't know if you're going to die if you caught it. It was terrible, wasn't it? And she said, jokingly, some shoes would be nice. And I said, okay, I'll be there tomorrow. And I went up to our warehouse where they make the gift cards in Thrapston. And I said, give me 50 gift cards in a Geiger carrier bag. And I drove them down to Portsmouth, and I wasn't allowed to meet her. You know, we weren't allowed to meet anyone. And I left them behind the sign at Portsmouth Queen Alexandra Hospital and said to her, there's 50 £100 gift cards behind the sign. And then I thought, actually, that's the joy, because she sent me pictures, yeah, of giving them out in A&E. And I thought, this is what we're going to do. So the next week, we did that to 57 hospitals where we have stores. We said, we're going to just give our product away. Who cares? I don't really know how it works from a finance perspective. You know, who cares, really? My finance director was like, this is brilliant, but you know this is going to cost us like millions of pounds. I'm like, well, whatever, it doesn't matter. And So our managers and me and whoever we could get delivered thousands of £100 gift vouchers right across the NHS. And that became part of a spirit that we thought we're going to maintain this. So actually we're formalising our kindness this year. We're launching a charitable foundation. We've just been approved by the Charity Commission, and we're going to be putting probably £2 million a year into a foundation to support youth creativity.
That's amazing.
People like me, but, you know, yeah, in a much worse situation, that loved to draw but didn't really know how to make that into a job,
yeah,
is what we're going to do.
Amazing. That's so cool. So where do you see the future of the high street?
I'm very optimistic about the high street. I think we love shopping. We like going out. We're opening 21 stores this year. We'll open more stores, I think, than any retailer in the UK. So I'm very optimistic about it. We think that it's a big part of the future. Is the problem with shoe shops, actually, to be specific. And that's why, you know, we need to have the rates and all those miserable things change, is that a third of the shop is a stockroom. So it's hard to make money in a shoe shop. Now that we're 50% handbags, it's a little bit more helpful, frankly. So shoe shops are pressured because of you can't use all the shop, and you need more staff than a normal shop because the stock is in the stockroom. So I think we're under pressure for shoe stores, but I'm optimistic about the high street.
I also think it's the one thing that you do like to try on before you buy.
It is.
There's lots of things that you think, because I think handbags, you can sort of imagine how it looks on your arm or on, you know, crossbody, whatever. Footwear, I feel like
I want to try it on.
I don't know.
I think that is a benefit of shoe shops. So there's a benefit of shoe shops. And I love, you know, I love shoe shops. And because I struggle with spending a long period of time in any one place, I love going out to our stores the whole time, and I drive everyone mad by doing that because I remember what it was like to be a store manager. You learn more from talking to Rob in Brighton, as I was there on Friday, than you do looking at spreadsheets in the office.
What does sustainability mean to Kurt Geiger, and how is it impacting you?
Well, it's vital to all of us, isn't it, really? And we're trying to find all different ways to be more sustainable. It's such a challenge, and we've got this big exercise about how we can take our shoes, our shoe returns, our old shoes, and make them into things. We've got this little secret project about how we want to make our stores in the future out of shoes. You know, 60% of our shoes come from China. You know, it's not something that is very easy to come to terms with. The fact that we are selling less product now, but at higher prices and better quality, I think maybe is a good thing. Even though our sales are up now, we're selling less pairs of shoes. So I think there's so many different things we should be doing. And, you know, my kids keep me on the straight and narrow there, obviously, too, because for the younger people of the world and for all of us, it's a critical thing.
Well, I think everyone's on their own journey.
Yeah.
And I think that's the important thing to remember. As long as you're on the journey.
We're on the journey.
And that you're not greenwashing. I think if you're on the journey, then you've got to do stuff that's right for your business in a timely manner.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that's we've
just recruited a new head of supply chain and sustainability who's joined us from Dr. Martin's. We've given him the challenge to speed up some of the efforts that we want to do that we've written down. How do we make it work in theory?
So I think this is going to be probably my last question before we go on to the quick fire questions. What has been your most challenging project? Has it been COVID, or is there out of COVID? What has been your biggest challenge?
Oh, well, I think it would have been COVID. I think COVID.
Did you actually sleep through COVID?
I had an awful time, actually. I was on the sofa a lot of the time. I was waking up at 1 o'clock in the morning. It was not fun. You know, you got a lot of responsibility, 3,000 or 4,000 employees, a business that was on the brink of failure. I don't often feel pressure, to be honest, but I did feel it at that point. But I turned it as much as I possibly could into energy to get through it and to say, okay, now's the time to earn your salary, Clifford.
So I'm going to go on to the quickfire round now. And they're not all written down there either.
Oh, okay.
Because I've thought of more.
Cool.
Formal or casual?
Oh, I'm a chameleon on that too. I think in the end, I'm casual.
What trend do you just not get?
I love to embrace as much possible in trends. Are we talking shoe trends?
Whatever trend.
Vegetarianism. I do like a sausage.
Favourite food?
Favourite food is sushi. Favourite food is sushi.
What's the scariest or bravest thing you've ever done?
Two things. Can I give two?
Yeah,
two?
You can. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
A bungee jump.
Yeah, that's quite scary.
Yeah, the normal bungee jump.
Queens. Was that in Australia?
In New Zealand, oh. You know, the normal one. And I was really rubbish at it. I've got the VHS video. It's super embarrassing. My wife was like super beautiful and I was useless. And shaving my hair off when I was had to admit that I was going bald, that was really difficult.
That's so interesting.
That's not one
you normally hear.
For the bald people on the podcast, you will know what I mean.
When do you feel most fabulous?
After playing tennis in the morning.
Nice.
I love tennis.
All the endorphins pumping through you.
Yeah, Highbury Fields.
Would you rather have an extra arm or an extra eye?
Arm.
What's your favourite book?
Because then I can change gear and keep two hands on the wheel.
You can just do automatic.
Yeah.
What's your favourite book?
I've never read a book.
Right. Do you read magazines or...?
I don't really get the fiction thing. I don't really know why people want to read stuff that's not real. And because I'm dyslexic, I've got like a million books that I've read the first two pages and then I forget and I have to start again.
Guilty pleasure.
Cutler and Gross glasses.
Nice. Is that a guilty pleasure? I feel like that's not that guilty.
I've got 50 pairs.
That's quite guilty. Are you tidy or messy?
More messy.
Do you should enjoy this, building flat
100%
furniture.
100% don't enjoy that.
I would have thought of all that work.
No.
No. Would you rather swim to work or cycle to work?
Cycle. Hate swimming.
I reckon you'd rather play tennis to work.
Actually, I don't like the word hate. I don't know why I said that. I don't like swimming that much. I find it super boring and I can't believe that people can do like 100 lengths. It would feel like I did it for a year. Every lap is like an hour.
Sun or activity holiday?
Sun, I think.
That was amazing. For more information on Kurt Geiger, where should our listeners go?
Go to our Instagram. Go to our Instagram, Kurt Geiger.
Thank you so much, Neil. It's been an absolute pleasure to walk in your shoes. For more interest in cordwainer's livery, please visit our website, cordwainers.org, or our Instagram, Worshipful Cordwainers.
Thank you very much.
Done!